From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Today is back to school for nearly 500,000 students across the California State University system, which is the largest public university in the country. When they arrive on campus, including here at Sacramento State, where our studio is located, they will be greeted by picket lines and faculty who are on strike. It is the first ever system-wide strike at all 23 CSU campuses. There are 29,000 faculty, give or take, including professors, lecturers, librarians, and other staff, and they're demanding a raise, along with a package of other benefits. The Cal State system has counteroffered, but the two sides remain stuck. This week-long strike actually follows a rolling one-day strike that happened at a few campuses, including here at Sacramento State, last month. We have two guests to walk us through the issues surrounding the strike. In a moment, we'll have Ashley Smith with EdSource, who will join us with more context on the back-and-forth negotiations. First, we begin with Cap Radio's Mike Haggerty, who is live at the J Street main entrance to Sac State. Hey, Mike.
Oh, hey, Vicky, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you. Well, thanks
okay,
for thinking.
Sorry about that.
No, that's
little technical glitch. So, hi.
Hello. You got a lot going on. I mean, I had the vantage point of driving into work. Our studio obviously is located at Sac State. But for people who haven't been in the area, kind of give us a scene setter. You have a front row seat right now. How does it look like?
Well, at this point, at the J Street entrance, the main entrance to Sac State, there are about 50 protesters walking in the area. And any students that are coming through, arriving for their first day at classes, are likely to see some familiar faces, professors, lecturers, librarians, counselors, and coaches. But instead of in their usual settings, they're seeing them marching up and down the sidewalk here on J Street, wearing bright red T-shirts with an illustration of an upraised fist and the words CFA on strike. They're beating drums, blowing horns, chanting and holding picket signs that have messages like faculty working conditions are student learning conditions, one semester parental leave now, and I'd rather be teaching, but I can't afford it. Now, the picketers are making sure that they're on sidewalks, that they're not in the street. They're going to occasionally cross to the other side of the street, but so far they seem to be making sure that they do that when they have a walk signal.
Got that. And I know this morning, I mean, when I was heading into work, I mean, the weather wasn't favorable for being outside. What is it like now?
Well, the weather since then has been better than expected. Yesterday, it looked like we'd pretty much see nonstop rain through the day today. Now, the Weather Service is predicting scattered showers until late afternoon when we could see high winds, heavy rain and thunder. But that could be around the time when the picketers would be calling in today anyway.
Yeah, and the horns that we're hearing behind you are vehicles that are honking in support of people who are protesting right now. Got it. You know, given that you're at the main entrance, J Street, is that the only location where there's a strike on campus?
No, Vicky, there's a second, slightly smaller group of demonstrators south of the J Street entrance at the intersection of College Town Drive and State University Drive. And again, they're sticking to the sidewalks and only crossing when they have a walk signal.
What should students know if they need to get on campus? It's the first week.
Well, so far there are no efforts being made to stop or even slow down traffic. So getting across campus and into parking lots is easy, maybe even easier than usual. It looks like many students who were aware from news coverage that this strike was coming may have just decided to stay home today.
You know, at a core of this kind of stalled negotiations comes down to salary. The CFA, the California Faculty Association, they want a 12% raise effective immediately. The Cal State system has some other offers on the table, and we're going to get to that later in this segment. But really, I mean, just the two sides, they are stuck on their negotiations. What are you hearing from faculty at Sac State?
Well, the official position of the CFA is that the university has disrespected them, and that what CSU says is its last, best, and final offer is simply unacceptable to them. Emily Bukowski is a lecturer in the geology department.
I think it's important to know that they've already decided to raise tuition, and that tuition is going towards administrative salaries. The chancellor, her annual compensation is up to $1 million a year. She gets paid more in a month than I make in a year for teaching five classes a semester. So we're really thinking about equity. We're thinking about priorities and making sure that the system is focusing on using the money that they get from that tuition hike, if they're insisting on having it, that it goes to the people and the facilities that make these universities run.
Yeah. Well, let's walk through some of the impacts on campus, the Cal State system, and of course, Sacramento State. I mean, they're trying to minimize disruption in classes and campus activities. What do you know?
Well, CSU itself, the university, is not canceling classes. They're leaving that up to the individual faculty members. All CSU campuses, all 23, will be open and operational. There are no changes to the academic calendar. And so far, both the university and the faculty association say they don't believe that this work stoppage on the part of the faculty will interrupt the students' ability to graduate on time.
And this is just the first day. There are 5 days in total, planning to strike through Friday. What's the sense that you get from speaking with faculty who are currently outside at the picket area about their level of determination to see this through?
You know, Vicki, especially given the last-minute decision by the Teamsters to accept CSU's offer, that was a big question that I had this morning. But Emily Bukowski says she and the other striking members of the CFA are committed to the strike unless the university asks them back to the table to consider a better offer.
It's about visibility. It's about showing that we're united for what we're demanding. Yeah, that's a good question. We are having impacts, you know, like classes aren't happening. Everything's kind of slowed down. Everything's delayed. And yeah, I don't know.
Are you prepared to do it again if this, in fact, doesn't bring the university back to the table?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've got some ideas flowing through the chapter level and through the statewide leadership about how and what would happen next. But no decisions have been made because we're hoping we don't have to resort to that.
Were you able to get a better idea about any future plans after Friday in case, you know, the two sides just don't come to an agreement?
No, Vicki, pretty much Emily Bukowski covered it there. There is no plan that they are ready to announce as far as a next step and no schedule for it.
Anything else you want to add for anyone who's just heading to Sac State today, whether a student or not?
Well, again, I mean, you hear the horns here. There's a decent amount of traffic, but it's moving freely. Depending upon who your business on campus is with, it might be a good day to do it. As we said, the strikers are making a point not to interfere with travel across campus or parking in parking lots. And with an undetermined number of classes canceled, there are actually more open parking spaces at Sac State today than there are most days.
Thanks, Mike, for the live report.
Thank you, Vicki.
And that is Cap Radio's Mike Haggerty, who is live along J Street, which is the main entrance to Sacramento State. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about a faculty strike across the Cal State System's 23 campuses that started today and is scheduled through Friday. I now want to bring in Ashley Smith. Ashley is a higher education reporter with EdSource and has more on the back and forth negotiations. Welcome, Ashley.
Hi, Vicki. Thanks for having me.
So you joined us last month, and this was during the rolling one-day strike at four CSU campuses that included Sacramento State. So now we are currently experiencing a week-long strike across all 23 campuses. What happened between the beginning of December when you joined us and now?
Well, I think the biggest change is that earlier this month, CSU ended contract talks and unilaterally decided to impose a 5% pay increase on the faculty. And they expect that to start January 31st. Both sides just could not reach an agreement. And we know back in October, there was an impasse and the fact finders report came out with some recommendations. But CSU forced this 5% on the faculty, and the union view it as essentially a slap in the face. I mean, the 5% increase is similar to what the other employee unions have recently negotiated with CSU for, but it is short of what the independent fact finder recommended in October, and it's definitely far short of the 12% the union wants.
So we heard from faculty who are striking, but I do want to break down some of the arguments that the CSU system is making. On Friday, they held a press conference via Zoom, and I'm going to play some excerpts from Vice Chancellor of Human Resources, Laura Friedman, and this is their response to if they actually met the demands of the faculty union.
The CSU currently spends about 75% of its operating budget on compensation. If we were to agree to the increases, we would have to make severe cuts to programs. We would have to lay off employees. This would jeopardize our educational mission and cause hardship to many employees.
Ashley, does this carry weight or is this more of a scare tactic?
Well, if you're agreeing with the administration side, then you can understand that they're in a tough budget situation. If you look at some of the cuts that happened and the lack of funding that they're getting from the state, you know, Governor Newsom's proposal earlier this month essentially is delaying some of the funding that they're going to get. The 5% increase that they were expecting to get this year have been delayed until next year. And so you can kind of understand what CSU is saying. There have been layoff threats at San Francisco State already because of budget cuts and budget tightening. But essentially, the faculty do not agree with that assessment. The faculty simply don't trust that what CSU is saying is true. You have to remember that this is all coming around the same time that in the last year, we have seen campus presidents receive pay increases, and the new chancellor did receive a much larger salary than her predecessor.
Yeah, yeah. I think including benefits in addition to the salary, it's around $800,000. It's upwards of $1 million, as we heard from a faculty member at Sac State just a few moments ago. The next excerpt I want to play, it actually touches upon what you said about how the CSU system, it unilaterally instituted or offered, you know, a 5% raise after negotiations just stalled. But the CSU kind of gave more context behind that. So let's take a listen to what they initially offered before negotiations fell flat, and then we can unpack it afterwards.
We've made several offers with movement, and most recently a 15% increase that would be paid over 3 years, providing faculty a 5% increase each year. But the faculty union has never moved off its 12% demand for 1 year only. Now that the bargaining process has concluded, we've decided to provide the union's members, CSU's professors, lecturers, coaches, librarians, and counselors, a 5% general salary increase. Our priority is to get these raises into employees' paychecks without further delay. As soon as they're ready to make meaningful movement in bargaining, we will be back at the table.
So what I heard from that was that the CSU system offered 15%, a 15% increase over 3 years, 5-5-5. But since that wasn't agreed to, the CSU is giving faculty 5%, which, as you said, starts this month. Is it as simple as that?
Yeah, it is that the 5%. But I want to be clear that I've talked to some faculty who say that 5% does not come close to meeting their salary needs, their wage needs, and dealing with the cost of inflation and rising costs pretty much everywhere. But yes, that's essentially what CSU did. They simply said, we're going to give you the 5% the way that they gave 5% to the other union.
And initially, when they offered the 15% over 3 years, I mean, obviously, that's more than the one-time 12%. But there are other things at play here. I mean, how far apart are they on negotiations? It's not just salary, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's not just salary. I mean, there's no agreement on the salary, obviously. But take, for example, the paid parental leave. Right now, professors get 6 weeks. CSU said they are willing to expand that to 8 weeks. That is still short of the full semester. And keep in mind that a full semester is about 15 to 16 weeks. That is still far short of what the faculty want. Another example would be hiring more counselors and adjusting their workloads. CSU said that they are willing to go with the recommendations from the independent fact finder and create a study and examine just how those workloads could change or how they can improve the working conditions for counselors. The faculty had said that what they put forward, the recommendations that they made, were based on international standards, and that is what they want, and they're not willing to budge from there.
Hmm. Is there a deeper issue beyond this current round of stalled negotiations between the faculty union and the CSU system?
You know, I think that there's just a lack of trust. The faculty essentially don't trust what CSU says. They've conducted their own studies, independent studies, I should say, into CSU's finances. And so there's just a fundamental disagreement over how much money this system has and where that money goes and how much should go to professors, how much should go to executives. It really comes down to a real lack of trust on the faculty side.
Hmm. This last clip from the Vice Chancellor of Human Resources is about the campus operations across 23 campuses, given that this is the first of 5 days of a planned strike during the first week of class.
The CSU respects the rights of the faculty union to engage in strike activity. Members of those unions may decide to strike and withhold work. That is their right. However, members of those unions may also choose not to strike. They may choose to come to work. Faculty may choose to teach their courses as scheduled. That is also their right. Any statement to the contrary, or any statement that no classes will be taught, is false.
Have you been hearing that? Is there confusion among students, you know, about, you know, what this week could look like?
Yes. I've talked to some students who say that, you know, all of their professors have said that their classes are canceled. And I've heard from students who said only one of my professors said that their classes would be canceled. It really depends on the instructor and how much communication did they have with their class. You know, some students are, you know, if you are attending Cal Poly SLO, you've been in class for about 3 weeks now, and so you may have had a little bit more communication. For the vast majority of students, this is their first week of classes, and so they may not have had as much communication with professors. So yes, it's a bit all over the place what students have heard, but you know, I think that the faculty and the CSU, they both have said to contact your instructors, try and see, you know, who is holding class and who isn't, and make sure you have that information available. You know, if there is a chance that these, you know, either side reaches an agreement at some point this week, I mean, students could be back in class, you know, in a few days, or, you know, this could go the entire week.
Yeah. So my next question touches upon that. I mean, the current contract with the faculty union, the CFA, it actually expires this summer. So it's pretty close. It's not that far away. And so soon there's going to begin bargaining on just a new contract. What happens after this week, after Friday?
Well, it's without getting too complicated, this strike is over the current year of the faculty contract. And so if there isn't an agreement reached at the end of this week, once this week-long strike is over, the union could, as you guys have heard from faculty members, they could decide to strike again. I've talked to faculty who said that they are willing to strike longer and deeper into the semester if there isn't an agreement reached. But at the same time, there is a new contract that needs to be negotiated. And so the faculty will start getting together this spring and coming up with their demands for that new contract and what their needs are. And that will be developing over the upcoming months. What's interesting is that the faculty and CSU may find themselves in a position where there's a disagreement over this current year reopening contract that they're striking over and where they're negotiating conditions for a completely new contract.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, a lot more for you to follow. In the last like 30 seconds or so that we have, I mean, your focus, your beat is higher education, given that this is the first strike of its kind across the CSU system. I mean, this impacts nearly 500,000 students, 23 campuses, the largest public university system in the country. What does this signal to you that this is happening?
Well, I mean, this is a pretty historic strike. And if we remember last year when the academic workers in UC won their strike and they saw better wages and working conditions, that really set the stage for CSU faculty to push forward with this strike of their own and to have better wages and working conditions. And I think that we're seeing a trend in a way and led in a lot of ways by these California institutions to push for better wages, better working conditions, and that they are willing to go to bat for what they want. And it's perhaps a trend that, you know, we'll see follow in other places, too.
Ashley, thank you so much for breaking all that down for us.
Sure. Thanks, Vicki.
Ashley Smith is a higher education reporter with EdSource, talking about a faculty strike that's happening across the Cal State system's 23 campuses, including Sacramento State. It started today and is scheduled through Friday. Up next, California has come full circle when it comes to embracing lowrider culture. We'll learn about an auto exhibit which celebrates ladies and lowriders. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Lowriding and cruising. For many, driving and building these cars are symbols of culture and art that go back generations. And it's deeply intertwined with California's Latino and Latinx community. And the state has come full circle when it comes to embracing lowrider culture, from celebrating its history to overcoming stigma. Starting this year, a new state law outlaws lowrider bans across California. And here in Sacramento, the story of lowriding and cruising has been on display at the California Museum, as well as the Sacramento History Museum. Now it's been joined by a brand new exhibit at the California Automobile Museum, which honors the contributions of one particular group, women. Titled Rucas y Caruchas, Ladies in Lowriders, the exhibit held its grand opening this weekend, and it highlights the cars and the culture of female owners, builders, designers, and drivers. Joining us now to talk more about the exhibit is Shavala Rodriguez, the exhibit's manager at the California Automobile Museum, and her daughter, Nayeli Rodriguez. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Good Thanks morning. For having us.
So I want to start with the backstory. How did you get involved with lowriding, and which really culminated into a museum exhibit?
I've been into lowriding since I was very young. I can remember as far back as 3 years old with my dad. He was always working on something in the garage, whether it was a car or a motorcycle or helping me build a lowrider bike, and my brother as well, and the neighborhood kids. And so it's just a passion that I've had all of my life. But then life happens, you know, you have your kids and your family, and, you know, some people continue to keep a part of that culture. But for us, it was focusing on establishing things with our family, getting our house and doing all that fun stuff. And then my husband and I decided, you know, it's time. Let's get a car. So we started with our first car that had no back seat, no headliner. We went to the thrift store and bought a bunch of quilts and kind of made a makeshift back seat for the kids to hang out in. And we put our phone in the top part of the where the headliner would go. And that was our music for a long time. And then that love just grew, and it was a family affair. All of our kids have been involved from the beginning, whether that's helping fix the cars or clean the cars, helping in community events. And I worked a long time as a retail manager, and then COVID came along and went back to work. And it was like, you know, all that time during COVID reflecting, is this really what I want to do? I would really like to be more part of the community and serve the community better. And then we were approached while at a car show at the California Auto Museum. and was like, you know what? Like, this is so spectacular. All of these beautiful cars and all of these lowriders and families out here, we need to do an exhibit. So the first exhibit that we did was The Art of Lowriding back in 2022 at the California Auto Museum. And it was all over. It's the first time that Sacramento really did something like that for the lowrider community and culture. And I think it really opened a lot of eyes because generally the auto museum is a bunch of older white guys that are into just classic cars or custom hot rod style cars. And this opened a whole new culture of cars for them. I mean, it was unbelievable how many kids and family and women were there. And so they loved the diversity. So it was really nice to see now when we have different car show events like lowrider car shows that a lot of these older white guys are showing up to them and saying like, man, we saw this online and we figured we'd have to come and check it out. So that really opened, you know, a door for that. And in the midst of that, a lot of the council members came out to the opening of that show, and we had basically an opportunity to talk to them about our culture. And that's what kind of opened the doors in regards to like the Sacramento Lowrider Commission and the repeal of the no cruising ordinance. And I thought that while we were doing all that stuff, it was very important for our kids to be involved because this is a part of history. And so Nayeli had been with us to every council meeting. She spoke in front of all the council members and in front of the mayor as a youth liaison for the lowrider culture. So then went that. And then after the repeal of the ordinance, it was like, well, let's, what else can we do in the history part? And so then we spoke to the Sacramento History Museum with Delta Mello, and she was like an amazing partner, and also Amanda Meeker and Amanda Sanchez over at the California History Museum, and said, you know what, we would like to do something that showcases the lowriding culture and the history that's been so rich here, not only in California, but in Sacramento as well. And so...
You're detailing so much work that happened in, you know, less than 2 years. And a lot of it became a reality, you know? I mean, it really just like took a village. And I think a lot of you would say it's long overdue. The fact that this is passed down from generation to generation to generation, it's not just, you know, fixing up a car. And no. Nayeli, it's something that you were very passionate about as well, given that you've talked to city council members about it. What do you think it is about low riding, why it transcends generations from, you know, your mom's parents to your mom to now you?
It's the feeling that you get when you're cruising in general. It's like growing up, you felt like you were famous when you were cruising in the car, like to Old Sac or just downtown, and everybody's staring at you. It's just, you know, that feeling, and it makes you so prideful of your car and being able to cruise in one. And then the feeling of the music, you know, like it puts you in different moods. Like sometimes it's more the soothing, calming feeling, or like it just makes you want to dance. And, you know, so just those different mixes of emotions and seeing all of your friends that you think of as family, it just puts a good feeling in you.
I mean, you really hit on it when you said pride, because it takes a tremendous amount of work and patience and time and skill to work on these, and you were part of that with your family.
Yeah. Ever since I was younger, I've always taken a lot of pride in like the culture I grew up in, because at first, you know, you didn't really see it around, but as I've been growing, I've been starting to see a lot more people like, oh, I wish I was involved with that, you know? So it's, over the years, it's even made me even more prideful about being a part of it.
That's wonderful, you know? And also, I mean, I think a big piece of it that I've learned about is that, you know, there's also fundraising tied to it. Like, you're such an integral part of the community. You know, why do you think it keeps going and going and going, and why even your children are so receptive to lowriding culture?
I think it's just the feeling that it gives you, giving back to the community, looking back and saying, you know what, we were a piece of that positive impact on another community that was in need at a certain period of time, and saying, you know, like we did that. For the kids, I think it's watching and mimicking what we're doing and getting that same feeling of I get what my parents were talking about when they say, oh, we've spent all these hours creating these community events or shows or fundraisers. Because at the end of the day, when you walk away, that feeling is so good to you that you know that you've helped.
Yeah. It may also, you know, come as a surprise to some people. You know, it's obviously incorrect. But when you think about, you know, car culture, you know, you mentioned classic cars or hot rods, you know, you typically, and you go to car shows, you typically only see, you know, men, you know, and that may incorrectly extend to low riding as well. But this exhibit is unique because you're focusing on ladies in low riding. Talk about how women have been involved since just the beginning.
Well, you know, after we finished the Boulevard Dreams exhibits, it was like, you know what, we need to do something dedicated to the women. Specifically for me, this was a dedication to my daughters because they watch their moms. You know, this is for all women out there who have been silent members of car clubs. You know, these guys don't cook the food by themselves. They don't organize these events by themselves. There's a lot of times that they have women behind them that are helping organize and orchestrate a lot of these big fundraisers and events. But because they're not a plaqued member, they're not getting the recognition. And now women are finally saying, you know what? Like, for a while it was like, I raised my kids and now I can finally do this. But now women from the gate are saying, no, I'm saving my money. I have a job. I'm going to pick the car that I want. I want this car designed the way I want. And a lot of times they may have their husbands or boyfriends or significant others that help them, but a lot of times they're doing it on their own. And I think as more and more women are doing it, it's encouraging to others. Mm-hmm. So an exhibit like this is really saying, you know, hats off to these ladies who have been doing this for such a long time. I mean, a lot of the women that I spoke to, they've been doing this, you know, since the 50s and 60s when car clubs were around, but they were always the silent shareholders in this. And now they're standing up and saying, no, that's my ride. Mm-hmm. I mean, for instance, I can be driving my car down the street and so many guys will stop and say, like, oh, is that your husband's ride? Or, oh, your husband let you drive that? And it's like, no, this is my car. He has his own car. This is my car. And I think that's a real sense of pride for women now, and especially to be showing the younger generation that this can be done, and very prideful. And we all are here to empower each other. I mean, these women were out there when this show started, when their cars rolled in last week. And it was like, okay, you know, you need help wiping down your mirrors. You need help wiping down your car. Do you need help hanging anything for the exhibit? I mean, everyone was hands on and ready to like make this the best possible. And so I really love the connections that it made.
What does, for people who don't know, Rucas y Caruchas, what does it stand for?
So Rucas is like a term for a female, a lady, so lady. And then Carucha is another slang term for your car, like a Carucha or your Rampla or your lowrider, your car, your ride.
Love it. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Shavala Rodriguez from the California Automobile Museum, along with her daughter, Nayeli Rodriguez, about their newest exhibit, Rucas y Caruchas, Ladies and Lowriders. And it opened this weekend and is running through April. Nayeli, you know, given that this is focused specifically on women, on ladies and low riding, your mom is a perfect example. What have you learned from kind of the elders in low riding? What have they taught you?
Oh, I can't even say a list of everything. Like, just like how to, you know, dress. Sometimes, like, they just help you with when it's like accessories or something like that. Like, learning how to put my chola bands on when I was younger, or, you know, creasing my pants when I was younger. And for the cars, it's just like wiping them down, or whenever my dad's outside working on the cars, I'll go out there, I'll give him a hand, and I kind of learn what everything does in the car and kind of little parts that function. So that's one of the parts. And during this exhibit, it was really exciting and it made me super pumped to get my car out there and, you know, just seeing all these other girls have their cars in progress or fully finished and everything. So it just, it's really inspiring.
What would you like people to know who go check out the exhibit since it just opened over the weekend? Do you have like a favorite part of the exhibit?
Everything. Just it. There's no
Take
favorite
your time.
Part. You know, there's like the vanity that shows how it was back then for them getting ready and all the work that they've put into their cars and just their stories about them. You know, it's super inspiring for me.
How about you, Shavala? What do you want people to know who are going to be checking this out?
I just want people to see all the women's stories and some of the struggles that they've gone through. We have did a call out to lady lowriders, and they put their stories into me, and they're printed on 6-foot banners on the wall. And so it's very inspirational to hear. They're all from different walks of life, different ages. And so to me, that really is the takeaway, the stories behind what was going on, because you can look at a car and it's great to see all the work that they've put into, but the story behind it, why did they pick that car? What got them into lowriding? Was it an aunt? Was it an uncle? Was it neither parent and they were driving down the street and said, oh my God, I love that paint job and I'm going to have one of those one day. And those are all the stories that are compiled through this. So I would say, yes, definitely when you come in, take your time and look at all the tiny details. It's an experience. Mm.
Thank you for making it a reality.
It's been my pleasure.
Yes, and it's for the benefit for a lot of people who are going to be taking this in and experiencing it. Shavala Rodriguez is the exhibits manager for the California Auto Museum, along with her daughter, Nayeli Rodriguez. And we've been talking about the museum's latest exhibit, Rucas y Carruchas, Ladies and Lowriders. It is on display through April. Still ahead, a Sacramento food company is putting a unique Latin spin on backpacking comfort food inspired by authentic personal recipes. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. I remember my first backpacking trip. It was hiking on steroids, and I do look back on it very fondly because it was just such a beautiful and humbling experience. I can pretty much relive the specific moment after you burn like a tremendous amount of calories hiking up switchbacks, eventually off trail with a permit, that the time finally came, you got to plop down, take the backpack off, and you get to have a warm meal. It might not sound like it, but boiled water and dehydrated food can be very, very satisfying. And backpacking food has really come a long way, from chili, beef stroganoff, mac and cheese. Not hating, I eat that too. But now it incorporates a wider variety of comfort food. And a Sacramento kitchen is adding their own spin with authentic personal recipes. Martha Diaz is the founder of the Latin backpacking food company, Itacate, which will start selling at REI stores. Welcome.
Hi, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
Oh, this was so exciting. And we did get to try some of your backpacking food. Absolutely loved it. We'll dive into it in just a moment. But first, where did your love for the outdoors, where did it come from?
Yeah, so I came to the U.S. with my family at age 10. And going outdoors, experiencing the outdoors was a big way of getting to know our new home. And so since then, that's been a really big part of my life and my identity, and have used really the outdoors as a tool in so many ways in my life.
Yeah, the outdoors is one thing. That's kind of like an umbrella term. Mm-hmm. Hiking is another. Backpacking can be something entirely different for a lot of people. It takes a lot more commitment. Mm-hmm. When were you drawn to backpacking?
I was drawn to backpacking starting in college. I didn't try it, though, until a couple of years after, because it felt really intimidating. Yeah, I didn't see people like me. I didn't know where to start. Just felt like there's so much equipment and things that I didn't know. And it wasn't until about 2015, actually, for my bachelorette, that my girlfriends and I decided to go for it.
That's an awesome bachelorette. Yeah, who needs Vegas? Let's go backpacking. So while you were backpacking, you know, back in 2015, what was like the variety and quality of backpacking food? What was it like?
Yeah, there wasn't very much of it. It was really conglomerated. It was before a lot of small brands came in and disrupted that space. And so, yeah, like you mentioned in your introduction, a lot of beef stroganoff, mac and cheese, chili. So food that, yeah, we ate just because that's what was available, but it wasn't food that was comforting or nostalgic. And I actually read an article in the Seattle Times shortly after my first time backpacking that ranked the best backpacking meals. And they concluded that the best choice, the winner they chose, not because it was the tastiest, but because it was flavors that were nostalgic to them and it was comforting during a hard time. And I thought to myself, wow, like, I didn't realize other people could have that, because that's definitely not an experience that I'm having out there.
Yeah, I think that highlights that backpacking food isn't just fuel, you know? I mean, there's also this connection that you can have to culture, comfort food. How does that familiarity add value to the outdoor experience?
Yeah, I think, like I said, I went out there with my girlfriends and, you know, we wanted to go out there for so long. And once we did it, it was like, oh, my God, this is amazing. Like, this is something that this is a way that we want to experience the outdoors. And it was so special. But the food was just like a really big pain point in that experience of, yeah, having these kind of activities are type 2 fun activities, right, where they're maybe not, they're hard in the moment and they're fun in hindsight. And so having that connection is just like, I don't know, it's just having that piece fit just like completed the picture.
How did that lead to a backpacking food company? When did you decide to like take the leap when the, you know, the light bulb went off?
Yeah, the idea had been there for a long time. And much like your previous guest in 2020, when the pandemic hit, it kind of was a really abrupt disruption to life. And it got me to reflect on my professional experience and whether what I was doing was something that I wanted to do long term. And the answer was no. And I thought about, like, okay, what are my passions and my values and my skills, and how do those align? And very much also, that's when this idea for backpacking
did you have
came.
A culinary background, or how did
no.
that yeah when did how did that come into play?
Yeah, I have a science background, but I've always been very much into food. And I think also being an immigrant, that connection to culture through food is very important and a big part of my identity. So having the food component be a part of my identity, as well as the outdoors, and being also like very inspired by the work that really awesome organizations like Latino Outdoors, Outdoor Afro have been doing for a really long time to increase diversity in the outdoors was just like the impetus.
So your company is called Itacate. Yes. What does that mean? What does it stand for?
Yeah, so Itacate comes from the Nahuatl Itacatl, and it's a word that's very commonly used in central Mexico for the bundle of food that you take with you after you go to a gathering that you're given. It also literally means food for the journey. So it just felt very literal and very fitting.
And the recipes also have such a personal connection to you. They come from your family.
Yeah. Yeah. These are recipes that I grew up eating. And like the lentil soup, for example, that's something that my mom makes all the time. And she pitched very hard for me to include that one.
Yeah. We tried the lentil soup. It is amazing. It is awesome. It's also vegan and great amount of fiber in there as well and nutrient. And also the chilaquiles, which were awesome. And I loved the salsa. Is it like a tomatillo salsa?
It's a tomatillo salsa.
How do you dehydrate salsa compared to, I mean, a lentil I can kind of understand, but salsa, and it was delicious.
Thank you. Yeah, we're freeze drying. So I tried dehydrating and it just like the flavors didn't come through. And so I decided to go the freeze drying route. So I have a big old freeze dryer, which is a blessing most times, sometimes a curse, dealing with equipment issues. But it's been, yeah. So we make the salsa from scratch. A lot of the components we make from scratch at 24 Hour Kitchens here in Fair Oaks. And we freeze dry right then.
That is awesome. And I imagine, even though you didn't have a culinary background, your science background comes into play. I mean, food is science as well, cooking.
Yeah. And especially when you're making a product that, you know, you have to keep it consistent. Like, there's a lot of math, a lot of spreadsheets developing the recipes are basically formulas. So
have people been receptive to Itacate, the meals that you're preparing right from the beginning, or was it a larger hurdle to get people to be receptive?
You know, at first, when I was working on it, I thought, like, I'm just going to squirrel away and work on this, and then I'll worry about, like, getting attention or whatever later. But from the start, I think people have been so supportive, and the biggest feedback that I get is, It was about time. Like, why this should have existed way long ago. And it's, you know, everything from people being grateful that this is available and having more options to really emotional responses from folks who just never thought that they could see their culture reflected back to them in this outdoor space.
Oh, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, because we have had conversations on Insight before just about the barriers to the outdoors. Yeah. I mean, we've even talked to the National Park Service about this. I mean, it can be so costly for a variety of reasons, whether it's the entry fee, travel. I mean, gas is expensive, the equipment, gear, supplies. I mean, the list goes on. And that obviously can shape diversity, socioeconomics, or lack thereof on the trail and in the outdoors. Was this something, I mean, you did touch upon this. This was something that you noticed as well when you first started going outside, going into the outdoors and experiencing it.
Yeah, definitely. Because even though I was going out with my family, doing hikes and bike rides and having picnics, backpacking felt so intimidating. And because I didn't have previously anyone to, you know, show me the ropes, then it made it even more intimidating, right? But once, actually, my good friend Samantha, her roommate, took her out, and she just showed her, like, this is how you filter water, this is how you navigate, all these things. And she was the one who pitched us all going out for my bachelorette. And, you know, we were probably, like, severely underprepared, but we went out there. And since then, like, whenever I plan a trip, I try to bring someone new so that they can spread the love too.
That's such a great point, because when I went backpacking, like, no one in my family went backpacking. Right. So, but the reason why I kind of got the confidence to do it was because I went with people who had backpacking experience. Yeah. Like, my husband has, like, slept outside for, like, a week, you know, in the outdoors. Yeah. So he had that confidence. I had a coworker who lent me, like, a bear canister, you know, so that actually really helps having that people who feel comfortable, and then that comfort transcends to you as well.
Definitely. Yeah. And now there's also so much content on social media and even more outlets for renting equipment or acquiring secondhand equipment, which I think wasn't, when I started, I don't think that was like a big outlet. And now it makes it a lot more approachable.
I'd love to also talk about your initiative. It's called Juntos Outdoors. Yes. I mean, and this is in partnership with your food company, Itacate. Mm-hmm. What does this initiative add overall to the food company that you started?
Yeah, so Juntos Outdoors, as Itacate, myself personally, I believe that the world is a better place when everybody gets to have an opportunity to have the outdoors as a resource in their lives, right? For whatever it is, physical health, mental health, just to have that option. And so we are choosing an organization every year to support, to increase diversity in outdoor participation.
That's wonderful. Yeah. When it comes to, you know, actually buying your product, where can people find your meals and your food, your backpacking food?
Yeah. So right now on our website, itacatefoods.com, but also very soon, like in the next couple of weeks, at rei.com, and then in about 10 stores. Unfortunately, not in any of the local stores, but along the West Coast.
But also online as well.
Yes.
So I mentioned chilaquiles, obviously the lentil soup as well. What other meals do you have?
Yeah, we have our sunset caldo, which is an interpretation of caldo tlalpeño, which is a very popular stew down in Mexico City. And then our fourth one that we just launched is an arroz con leche that's plant-based. It's a Aventura arroz con leche, and it's coconut milk-based.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Oh, that would be so good on the trail.
Yeah.
You know, finally, I mean, this all came, you know, during the pandemic. A lot of people were reevaluating, you know, what they wanted out of their life. And this led to this food company. You know, if someone has an idea but is intimidated, you know, to take that leap just as you did, I mean, what advice would you give them?
I would say go for it. I think really the biggest hurdle in my experience was myself, right? And so just getting over those boundaries and realizing like, okay, how far can I get on this without anyone stopping me, which is an experience, unfortunately, that I had had before professionally. And yeah, now we're at REI.
Yeah, that is amazing. Martha, it was so great to meet you and congratulations.
Yeah, thanks so much, Vicky.
Martha Diaz is the founder of the Sacramento-based Latin backpacking food called Itacate, and it will start selling at REI stores. But of course, you can also buy the backpacking food online, and we have a link on our website. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great rest of your Monday. Insight will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. and we will catch you back here tomorrow live at noon.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.